want the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest from peterbcollins.com. Our program is supported by great individuals who subscribe, and you can do it too. My thanks to Joseph Clarici, Joey Hundred, Michael Gill, and Faith Peoples. All the information about subscriptions on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, Professor Randall Ray, an economics professor at the University of Missouri, will join us to talk about Obama's grand bargain. And will he sell out the social safety net, particularly Social Security and Medicare, in trying to cut a deal over the fiscal cliff and the deficit with Republican leaders? But first, we're going to talk about the affair of Petraeus and Paula.
Paula, I want to marry you. Hey, Paula.
Oh, I don't know if that's coming down the pike.
No one else could ever do. I've waited so long for school to be through.
On the Friday after the election, the nation was pretty well stunned when they learned of the resignation of David Petraeus as head of the Central Intelligence Agency, where he'd been for only 14 months after serving as a much-celebrated and overhyped commander in Afghanistan and prior to that in Iraq. And while much has been made of the sordid exposures that we're seeing, and they keep on coming, with the twin sister of Jill Kelly and the FBI guy who sent, like, Anthony Weiner-style photos to Jill Kelly, and still more to be revealed about the correspondence between Jill Kelly and General Allen in Afghanistan. I'm not so interested. While, you know, that stuff is catnip that's hard to resist and is going to fuel the news at the check stands for weeks to come, I'd like to see more scrutiny to the work of David Petraeus, to his connections to the neocons, and really to the failure of the policies that he is regarded as a hero for. Robert Perry is the guy who brings history and context to so many important current events, and he publishes at consortiumnews.com. He returns to our program today. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And you wrote within 48 hours of the resignation of David Petraeus a very important piece which describes the true history and background, and that's being lost in the flap over Benghazi, and we now know Petraeus will testify before probably a closed session of the Senate Intelligence Committee on Benghazi. But very little is being written about what he has presided over. And you have offered that kind of background and context. So first up, what should we know about David Petraeus as he slinks away from public office?
Well, first of all, he was, as you mentioned, overrated. He was his big claim to fame, of course, was the so-called successful surge of troops into Iraq in 2007. But the whole successful surge thing itself was a myth. It wasn't successful in terms of the gradual reduction in violence in Iraq. There were other factors that were much more important, and many of them occurred prior to the surge under Generals Abizaid and Casey, including things like the Sunni awakening, essentially buying off the Sunni tribal leaders to to not shoot at the Americans and instead shoot at al-Qaeda types. The killing of Zarqawi, who was the sort of ruthless leader of the al-Qaeda faction in Iraq, that occurred in June of 2006. The separation, really, of the Sunnis and the Shiites, who were engaged in a, who became sort of embroiled in this sectarian war, that was occurring in 2006. And then there were other things like the decision by the Shiite leader al-Sadr to have a unilateral ceasefire, which occurred in 2007, but was essentially dictated by the Iranians, who wanted to sort of calm things down in the region. And I think the biggest factor that led to sort of the gradual reduction of violence in Iraq was the decision, when it became clear to the Iraqis that the Americans were indeed leaving, that the Americans were going to leave essentially in defeat. And that, I think, was that sort of further calmed things down in Iraq. But the idea of giving credit to Petraeus for mounting this surge with an additional 30,000 troops, about 1,000 Americans died during this period. Of course, the death toll among the Iraqis was far worse. If you recall the that so-called the collateral murder video of people being gunned down in the streets of Baghdad was taken during that surge. So the whole idea of the surge as a success was itself a myth, and the ultimate trajectory of the U.S. involvement of Iraq continued toward essential defeat. The United States lost the war in Iraq, withdrew in the end of 2011, without very much to show for all the expenditure of blood and treasure. So the idea of making Petraeus a hero for something that, which was not nearly the kind of positive thing that the U.S. news media, the likes of CNN and others, made it out to be, is, I think, that the core of the myth of General Petraeus. He, what he did wasn't that successful, and then he made it even worse in 2009 when he took part in an effort, along with Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and the Joint Chiefs Chairman Mullen at the time, in essentially trying to direct a funnel. The new president, Barack Obama's decision on Afghanistan, into a similar surge, which was based on the idea that while the Iraq surge had been so successful, they proposed essentially the same thing for Afghanistan, and it also has turned out to be a failure.
And Bob, at that time, we were told that all options were on the table, but we know that withdrawal was not an option available, and that, to his credit, Vice President Biden advocated for a reduction in force and a change in strategy, and he lost that debate, that internal discussion. But the options arrayed before the president were troops, more troops, and even more troops, but never a discussion of you know, planning to leave at that stage.
Right. Essentially, Obama was given a series of options that either that were just either untenable or were what the what Gates, Petraeus, Mullen wanted, which was to escalate the war. And Obama tried to get other options, but he faced this sort of resistance. And one has to criticize President Obama for leaving in place, essentially, George W. Bush's high command. Gates, Petraeus, and Mullen were all Bush people. And so they effectively directed this young president, inexperienced president, in the direction they wanted by just narrowing the options to to their choices and leaving the others out or saying they were impossible. So for Obama to have gone against them would have put him in a very difficult political position as a new president with limited experience with the military, defying these supposed wise men of the military, these heroes, Gates and Petraeus in particular, were the toast of Washington, both of whom, I think, were not at all what their press clippings make them out to be, but the general consensus, the conventional wisdom of Washington, was that these guys were the folks who really knew stuff, and they were the ones who had to be followed. So basically, Obama capitulated to this maneuver. He did impose this idea that there was going to be a faster withdrawal than they wanted, and he did stick to that. He did pull down the surge troops faster than Petraeus wanted, but he nevertheless was sort of trapped into the escalation to begin with. And that was part of Petraeus's legacy, which doesn't really get mentioned much.
Mm-hmm. And then Petraeus was tapped to replace General McChrystal, who this does play into the media coverage that our generals get, because McChrystal agreed to an in-depth interview with Rolling Stone magazine, which was essentially the trigger for his removal, because he and some of his underlings were, you know, quoted or indirectly quoted in ways that were critical of the White House. And so then Petraeus was brought in to try to rescue the mess in Afghanistan.
Right, which also did not work out very well. The idea of using counterinsurgency, which was the big thing for Petraeus in Afghanistan, was a mission that was doomed to failure from the outset, and it has failed. The U.S. will talk about, the U.S. government will talk about some of the modest successes here and there, but essentially it is just masking a similar situation to what we saw in Iraq, the gradual, almost inevitable defeat of the U.S. forces, their withdrawal, and without much to show for it at the end of the day. So that was what Petraeus brought about, and his counterinsurgency idea in Afghanistan has not succeeded. Whatever that might mean in Afghanistan, would have required much longer period of time and a much greater investment of men and materiel. And that just was never in the cards, and really that should have been understood to begin with. But that's what happened. And after being in Afghanistan, replacing McChrystal, Petraeus was then picked to move over to the CIA when Gates finally left. Gates was, of course, Bush's holdover, mm-hmm. and he leaves in the summer of 2011. Obama moves Panetta, who had become a fairly much a trusted advisor to Obama, perhaps the most trusted of his national security team. And he had been at CIA and had overseen some of the counterterrorism efforts, obviously most notably the killing of Osama bin Laden.
And the expansion of the drone programs,
yeah.
Exponentially, particularly as compared to Bush's use of drones.
Right. And that was sort of their replacement for the troops, having all these troops committed to these different theaters. They were moving more to this concept of using unmanned drones much more aggressively. So Panetta was moved over to the Defense Department, and they had to fill the CIA job, so they picked Petraeus. In part because I guess as you know, Petraeus obviously knew the battlefield pretty well, but he also was considered a Republican who was somewhat of a threat to Obama's reelection. Should he either resign and run for the office of president, or at least resign and support the Republican nominee? So they basically kept him in the tent rather than him outside the tent.
Mm-hmm. And we'll come back to Afghanistan in a moment. But I want to talk about the remarkable image that David Petraeus has managed to cultivate in the American media, even before the exposure of his affair with Paula Broadwell. Her book was fairly well received, and it really fits the definition of hagiography. When I received the book, I leafed through it looking for any critical commentary, and when I didn't find any, I put it in the outbox and said, well, I'm not going to request an interview with her because this is just PR. And what do you attribute his rosy public image, even in his hours of disgrace? He is described as a great general, a great leader, a great American, and he really doesn't live up to that hype.
No, not in my opinion either. The key to understanding Petraeus is that he was very close to the neoconservatives. He worked closely with them. He was friends with many of the prominent neoconservatives. He tried to coordinate his efforts with them. And they returned the favors. He gave them great access to what they needed, and they gave him a lot of praise. And the neoconservatives, even though they are now sort of on the outs a bit more in Washington, remain extremely influential in terms of the think tanks, the op-ed pages, the talk shows. So they are there to sort of help shape the reaction. And if you remember, going back to 2007, the neocons were on the ropes because the Iraq War was widely seen by that point as being a terrible failure. There was all the lying about the WMD, but there was also the mishandling of the war and the fact that things were a lot worse than had been sold to the American people. So you had the neocons really in a corner. They then promoted the surge in early 2007 and late 2006, early 2007 as sort of the counter to this, and as they were able then to sell this concept of the successful surge, because it was sort of like, who could criticize the troops? And the troops were out there, so you have to give them the credit, even though they didn't really deserve the credit for what the trends were in Iraq after that point. But that was the way it was sold. CNN and all the major news organizations bought it. And so we had this myth about the successful surge. And so along with that, the neocons then were saying, see, we won the war in Iraq. If you recall, there was a Newsweek cover that was entitled Victory at Last. It turned out we didn't have a victory in Iraq, but that was sort of the conventional wisdom, misguided as it was.
Mm-hmm.
So within this sort of world, this sort of bubble of nonsense, David Petraeus was sort of elevated into this hero status. You know, if you want to give credit for some of those more positive developments in Iraq, you really should go back to Casey and Abizaid, who were pushing for the smaller footprint. And in fact, although people don't like the guy, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld had backed them. He was pushing for even a smaller footprint. He was pushing for a faster withdrawal. What was misunderstood in 2006 was that Rumsfeld had sided with his generals in pushing for a faster withdrawal from Iraq. And it was Gates who was brought in at the time, people thinking he was going to bring about the withdrawal, but he was actually taking the other side. And Petraeus, who were pushing for a deeper involvement in this, throwing more men and more soldiers and money into this mess, and so the people got that whole story wrong, and then when it came to how you evaluated it, and when you get to 2008, it was the successful surge, and mm-hmm. everyone placed the better situation, the moderately better situation in Iraq, and gave credit to the surge and to Petraeus. And even Bob Woodward, to his credit, in his book on this phase of the war, would agree with the position I'm taking. He said that the surge was not a major factor at all in the gradual decline in violence. There are other factors that are much more important. But still, the conventional wisdom of Washington was that the neocons got it right finally. Bush was a hero for having to have the courage to go for the surge. Petraeus was the brilliant general who implemented the successful surge. And that became the narrative, the storyline. It wasn't correct, but it had tremendous momentum. And even during the 2008 campaign, you may remember, candidate Obama, was actually taking a more nuanced and correct position. He was saying, well, the surge was a factor, but not there were other factors.
Right.
And he was hounded by the National Press Corps. George Stephanopoulos, Katie Couric, and ultimately Bill O'Reilly were saying, why can't you agree that John McCain was right about the surge? And ultimately, essentially, Obama threw up his hands and said, yes, okay, the surge was better than we'd ever expected. You know, he sort of, as a way to finesse this incredible pressure he was under politically to sort of accept the conventional wisdom, false as it was.
And then he decided that a PR mythical surge would be a good card to play in Afghanistan, as he was attempting to buy more time as the public opinion in the United States continued to mount against an expansion in Afghanistan.
Right. But that was also that he was given these very limited options and was sort of essentially corralled into supporting the surge. But as I say, he made the most serious mistake, and I wrote about it actually in 2008, saying when I said that he was making a huge risk, and I thought a mistake, in keeping around Bush's high command. If you remember, after the election in 2008, there was this whole Washington thing about the team of rivals. I mean, Lincoln's team of rivals.
Yeah.
There was a book entitled that, which I guess is the basis for this new movie on Lincoln. So this team of rivals, and so Obama sort of was swept up in this ridiculous notion that you should have, you should surround yourself with people who are really your enemies. And frankly, the full history of Lincoln is much more complicated than you might get from that, the quick phrase of team of rivals.
Mm-hmm.
But Obama sort of bought into it, and that's why he kept Gates around. Everyone said at that point that Gates was this wonderful guy. Gates has a whole dark history that we've talked about in the past, that of being very much a Bush character, a Bush operative, not at all an honest person, a person who was who really should have been in much greater trouble around Iran-Contra than he was able to escape that scandal by essentially waiting out the investigation. So you had Obama sort of buying into this notion that he should keep these people on to show some continuity with the war effort. And Petraeus was one of those people kept on and actually promoted and moved ahead. And you had others from the high command there. So Obama never took control, really, of his foreign policy. Even Hillary Clinton was pretty much on the side of the neocons. She had, from her time as New York senator, she had shown mm-hmm. herself to be someone very sympathetic to the neocon positions. She voted for the Iraq War and was sort of a, you might say, a neocon light. So Obama surrounded himself with these people and then found that they were not always doing what he wanted, even to the point of not giving him the options he asked for regarding Afghanistan.
Bob, another aspect in the burnishing of the image of General Petraeus really is the unchallenged work of the American corporate media, as our friend Ray McGovern likes to call it, the fawning corporate media. And we've seen in modern times, from Colin Powell to Norman Schwarzkopf and now to Petraeus, that we invest a lot of hype and a refusal to be critical of our military leaders. And it's part of the nationalistic jingoism that I'm so uncomfortable with that permeates the mainstream media in this country.
Right. I think Matthew Ho, the former Marine officer, has a piece on that, which we just published at consortiumnews.com, and he goes into this point in the context of Veterans Day and how wrong-headed it really is not to look at these military operations more critically. And I suppose a lot of this goes back to the Vietnam era, when the media kind of eventually bought into this idea that the anti-war protesters were too hostile to the war, and you know there's been this I think basically a myth, but the idea that soldiers were spat upon, I've never actually seen that proven or shown, but
right.
that has become sort of the recurring narrative of that period, and we should be ashamed of ourselves, and we should always support the troops, and that was then used very cynically and but rather brilliantly during the Reagan era, and then of course the first Bush era, to build up this idea that we had to support everything the military did, and so when there was the invasion of Grenada, we all had to be thrilled at that, and there was of course later on the invasion of Panama,
mm-hmm.
followed by the Persian Gulf War, where we had all kinds of celebrations, and it was this idea that we had to, that it was somehow un-American to say, hold it, are these imperial adventures the way to go? Is this the right thing to do? And if you were to raise questions about the purpose of the war, you were deemed anti-troop. Why are you disparaging the troops?
Mm-hmm.
And so people politically, they had to shut up because they started losing elections if they were too critical. And even for citizens, they were either ignored or denounced if they broke ranks. And we saw this play out with disastrous results, in particular in 2003, when there was, despite many Americans going into the streets and saying this idea of invading a country that's not threatening us was a bad idea, the news media at that point essentially ignored those voices, listened only to the military supporters and the Bush administration, and off we went to the invasion of Iraq, which I think in retrospect people look and say, well, how did that happen? But it was part of this phenomenon that voices critical of these kinds of activities were being shunned, and it was considered very controversial and politically untenable to stake out too strong a position against these kinds of activities, because you would be called anti-troop.
Well, I'll give you a personal example. During Operation Desert Storm, I hosted a radio show in San Francisco on a station that carried Rush Limbaugh. And so I was on after El Rushbo every day, and I disagreed with Bush's motives and the trigger point. And there was April Glaspie, the State Department official who was telling Saddam Hussein we wouldn't fight back. And so fast forward, the end of that operation, there is a Welcome Home the Troops parade in San Francisco. And I was instructed by the station manager not to attend, because I had been critical of the policies. And I defied him, and I said, look, it's a public event, and you have no right to tell me that I can't be there. And it was a little uncomfortable and slightly bizarre, but I felt it was important that, despite the fact that I had challenged the policies, that I had no issue with the troops, and that I could welcome them home just like anybody who had waved the flag and said, right on, Bush.
Well, there are a lot of examples like that, sadly. Obviously, there's the Phil Donahue case at MSNBC around the time of the second or the Iraq War invasion in mm-hmm. 2003, although there's always been disputes as to exactly what caused that, but I'm sure the fact that he was bringing on people who were critical of the war policy was indeed part of that. So you had this going on, and because of that, we never got real clear histories of those stories and of those important events. For instance, in the first Persian Gulf War, we now have the historical record much clearer, though it's hard to find. I've included it in one of my books, but it is that there was a desire on the part of George H.W. Bush to have the ground war. Basically, if you remember how that went, Saddam Hussein goes into Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
Bush says that will not stand, and there's the buildup begins. There's intensive aerial bombardment of Iraq, causing heavy civilian casualties and essentially devastating their under equipped army, and it's clear that the Iraqis are signaling they want to withdraw, they want to give up, the then Soviet President Gorbachev intervenes and offers to mediate this, and actually has an agreement in place that President Bush is aware of, and it is that the Iraqis will withdraw. Basically, leave their weapons behind, except for some light weapons, and everyone will be fine. And Schwarzkopf, General Schwarzkopf, who was in the theater, wants to accept the deal because he's aware that he's going to have to send men into harm's way
mm-hmm.
When they don't have to go, because they will have the goal had been accomplished. Kuwait has been liberated, whatever that would mean for Kuwait. But Bush, with the help of General Powell. Powell takes a position at that point. He's chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He sort of is quietly siding with Schwarzkopf, but unwilling to challenge Bush because it would damage his political standing.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets into the Oval Office meeting with Secretary of Defense Cheney there and others, and Bush wants to sort of essentially deep six Gorbachev's plan, but wants to kind of make it not seem like he's just completely blowing off the Soviet leader. So Powell suggests, how about if we give a unrealistic deadline? And so that's what they do. They come up with an unrealistic deadline because they want the ground war,
mm-hmm.
and they want the ground war for a specific purpose. And Bush explains it. He says, "I want the ground war because we have to kick the Vietnam syndrome once and for all." In other words, we have to get the American people to just love war again, because the Vietnam War is still in people's minds at this point, and the painful nature and the disaster of that. So Bush understands that if he has this sort of a demonstration ground war, It's totally unnecessary. Slaughters, you know, tens of thousands of Iraqis in this, and I guess 100 and some Americans die too. That will be a way to get the American people on board war again and get them all this nonsense of peace out of their heads. So that's what he does. And he has this, it goes on for 100 hours. It's essentially a turkey shoot. The Iraqis are fleeing. They're just being mowed down, bombed. There's a so-called highway of death where they're trapped and just incinerated by American bombs. And we all feel great about it. And, of course, the American press doesn't even show many of the photographs that were taken of these burned, hideous pictures of the Iraqis that was kept away from the American people. Which, you know, these photographs actually were circulated in Europe and elsewhere, but they were kept out of the American press because it might be kind of a downer.
Right.
And so the American press essentially collaborated in this public relations effort that involved killing tens of thousands of people for this larger sort of political agenda that George H.W. Bush had.
And it also exposed hundreds of thousands of American troops to whatever the cause of Gulf War syndrome is, depleted uranium or chemical weapons or...
Right. Some of that, yeah.
We're not sure what it is, but there are hundreds of thousands of veterans who live with the legacy of that decision.
Schwarzkopf did not want to do it, to his credit. But Powell went along with it. Cheney wanted it. Bush Sr. wanted it. And that's what they did. And then they did their big celebration. They wanted to make war seem really fun and cool again. And they succeeded largely. There were fireworks displays. There were tanks on the mall in Washington, so kids could play on the tanks. They wanted you to feel like this was great. And out of that, you had people like Colin Powell becoming heroes. And he was feted as this great, great leader. And also, if you dial forward a bit, people are inclined to believe Colin Powell when he shows up in 2003 to give his ridiculous speech before the UN about weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
Because this image of him as this great, noble, brave leader had been instilled. It wasn't real. It was a false image. The real image was a Powell being kind of a vacillating guy, semi-siding with Schwarzkopf, but when it really came to the moment of truth, kind of caving in and coming up with some excuse to allow the war to go forward, to allow these people to die. He didn't stand up to the president. He didn't say, that's really wrong, sir. I'm going to resign if you insist on getting people killed for no military reason. So anyway, he was elevated to that pedestal, and this has happened again and again. It happened with Petraeus.
Yeah,
elevated to this pedestal where people can't criticize him, because to do so is somehow un-American or anti-troop, and then we end up putting faith in people who haven't earned it,
mm-hmm.
who don't deserve it, and what happens consequently is that a lot of people die. They didn't need to be the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. They didn't have to be the surge period. Almost 1,000 U.S. troops died during the surge. People forget this. There was nearly 1,000 Americans were killed during the surge. Now, that and all the surge really did was it bought a decent interval. So George Bush, Dick Cheney, and the neocons could slip out of the White House without having a military defeat hung around their necks.
Yeah.
So it gave them a little time. So they could leave, they could pretend like they'd actually won the war, and then when the war ends up being a failure anyway, and no one really seems to notice. So that was how. So 1,000 American soldiers died, and obviously many, many more Iraqis died for the purpose of giving these guys an out. I mean, that's the reality. That's the hard truth. But instead, we'd rather have this sort of fuzzy feeling about how, you know, these great, wonderful leaders and doing the right thing. And obviously with Petraeus, it turns out that he was also very, very sloppy in terms of how he approached other things, as we now know, with his affair. But Another interesting point is in 2009, when Obama was still this novice president, Petraeus worked with the neocons behind the back of the president to build a public relations impetus in favor of the surge in Afghanistan.
Right.
He had people like Max Boot of this Council on Foreign Relations and Frederick Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute going into Afghanistan, getting total access to everything. Essentially, they were even instructing the generals what should be done. But because they were so cozy with Petraeus, and Petraeus he got rewarded because when they came back, they wrote these glowing accounts of how great things are going on in Afghanistan. If only we have the courage and the willpower to stick it out, we'll win. So there's also a very interesting moment in Petraeus' career where he, this is I think now we're now in 2010, when he's giving a testimony in the Senate, and his prepared testimony includes a mild criticism of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't repeat it in his oral testimony, but it's in his prepared testimony. And people on the internet sort of picked up on it and thought, oh, this shows what Petraeus is being kind of brave here. He's criticizing Israel. But what happens behind the scenes is fascinating. Petraeus freaks out. He's afraid he's going to be criticized for criticizing Israel. So he runs to Max Boot, his neocon's pal, and begs Boot to sort of help set a sort of a backfire. And Petraeus is saying, I never said those things. Yeah, they were in my prepared testimony, but I never actually said them out of my mouth, which, of course, is rather an odd distinction because prepared testimony is considered official.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Petraeus is going to Boot, begging him to help. Petraeus, even at the end of one of these emails to Boot, puts one of those little sideway happy faces, with a parenthesis, and they call them emoticons or something.
Right, yeah.
So he has this little emoticon thanking Boot for the help he's going to get. Boot then does a blog post and saying, it's unfair to suggest that General Petraeus is critical of Israel. Of course, he's a great supporter of Israel, blah, blah, blah. And then Petraeus then sends that blog post to one of the people who has been noting Petraeus' speech on the internet. But Petraeus forgets to delete the other emails below it. So he sends this thing, and it has, at the top of it, please read this email from Max Boot, or this blog post by Max Boot.
Mm-hmm.
But what Petraeus doesn't seem to realize is he's sending the whole email chain,
yeah,
which has in this begging Boot to help him out stuff. So
that
does reflect also, I guess, he's pretty sloppy in his email protocol, as we've seen again in this latest case.
Well, that's where I was headed, is that to see that our chief spook seems oblivious to the techniques that produce information that crosses his desk every day. I know he doesn't run the NSA, but the CIA gets information from NSA, and he's got to know the scope of the wiretapping, the interception of emails, and that setting up a Gmail account under a screen name doesn't give you any real protection. Yet, he got caught up in this FBI dragnet, and there are important questions to be sorted out about that as well. But, Bob, let me close by asking you to describe what the opportunity here is. Because with Panetta, presumably, he hasn't officially announced, but since they're talking about sending John Kerry to defense, I think we can infer that Panetta's days are numbered. He wants to retire. We've got this opening at the CIA. I expect the president will plug John Brennan in there, the master of the drones program. We've already selected a replacement for General Allen in Afghanistan. But do you see an opportunity here to purge the neocon groupthink and for any new ideas, new views, new blood in the Obama intelligence and foreign policy team?
Well, Petraeus was a neocon, essentially a plant or operative inside the high level of the U.S. government or the Obama administration. And he did, in one case, he actually had some did some damage to them because at a point a year or so ago when there was a movement with Iran, if you remember, there was this crazy story about the Iranians supposedly trying to assassinate the Saudi ambassador. And the White House and the Justice Department didn't think it was, they thought it was kind of nonsensical that it wasn't, it didn't involve the Saudi, the Iranian leadership and shouldn't be given, be treated very seriously. Petraeus, however, over at CIA insisted that it be treated very seriously. He doesn't like the Iranians. He's been trying to essentially throw to sabotage any kind of agreement with the Iranians, and so you had so he pushes this thing and it becomes then a big deal. The press in the U.S. picks up and buys it whole cloth, buys you know just hook, line, and sinker.
Mm-hmm.
And the it turns out we now know that that the guy who was at the center of it, this guy Arabziar, was according to his, to the psychiatrist hired by his own defense team. He suffered with a bipolar disorder and was basically not all there. He was kind of he was not someone to be relied upon, as Petraeus did. But so here comes this situation where Petraeus then stumbles into this scandal, and Petraeus thought he'd be covered up. It would be all taken care of, and he would continue on. But it didn't work out that way. And I think part of it is I'm told part of it is that the Obama administration doesn't particularly like Petraeus. They consider him someone who's undercut them, and who favors more the neocon position of pushing the Iran controversy and crisis more toward a war than they when they think it can be settled peacefully. So yes, the allowing Petraeus to sort of fall in this way, in this rather tawdry way. Not that they set him up, he set himself up, but you know, not sort of coming up to cover up for him or give him some graceful exit,
right,
probably has the effect of weakening the neocon position further. And the neocons now find themselves pretty isolated when it comes to the executive branch, more isolated than they've been in really the last 30 or so years. They lost Bobby Gates at Defense, and he was one of their, not exactly a neocon, but an ally. And now they've lost Petraeus, who was their last remaining key ally in the executive branch. So, and with Hillary Clinton leaving, who tends to lean toward the neocon positions often, they are finding themselves more removed from power. Now, how Obama handles that, whether he uses this opportunity to bring in people with a less aggressive, less imperialistic kind of view, we'll see. I don't know. I don't have any particularly great insights into who he's going to be appointing to these positions. John Kerry, who's been talked about for State as well as Defense, is someone who is certainly not a neocon and finds their positions quite objectionable.
Mm-hmm.
So you might see more of a movement toward a more reasonable approach. And Panetta, even though, yes, he has been involved in some of these the use of the drone program, is someone who also has been pushing to sort of have a peaceful resolution of the Iranian situation, which is really the key thing right now, is whether or not the Iran crisis will be moved more toward a possible military confrontation or will be settled. And Obama favors really settling it, and I'm told is going to be moving on that fairly quickly. And he seems to be clearing the decks a bit, not entirely of his own making, because Petraeus sort of took himself out of it, but it does seem to be that Obama has a chance to finally have his own team in control of the foreign policy, something he probably should have done at the beginning of his presidency, but he's now doing it. We'll see what his team will look like, though. I'm not saying the team will necessarily be sweetness and light, but it will be, I think, a team more devoted to his strategies, not off on their own.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for the context and the history that you provide. And also, thanks for bringing up the Arbabsiar case, because I've been ranting about that ever since the news broke, and you make me seem a little less crazy.
Well, it's amazing how these conventional wisdom kind of things get going, and the Washington Press Corps never seems to learn lessons, even though it should have learned something, I guess, from the Iraq War, but never seems to learn, and they get suckered by the next one and the next one. This one although we don't know the full story, I suppose. But
well, and he has
certainly he's, not something to base the kind of confrontation over that that it was that as it was used.
And he's taken a guilty plea, so it will zip up any trial, any exposure of the real evidence against him, and we are left with a story that is treated as fact, despite the very clear lack of evidence to support it.
Right, and his own attorney saying the man is psychologically unfit,
mm-hmm.
and that he is being relied upon to provide information that has advanced a possible war situation in the Middle East is rather stunning, and the fact that the U.S. press corps bought into it again is a further indictment of them too.
Robert Perry, read his work at consortiumnews.com.
Thank you.
Like a blockbuster film to be released right after Thanksgiving. We've been seeing the trailers for The Fiscal Cliff all summer long. And now, it's here.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within.
Can you dig it?
Smiling faces.
Yes, in the lame duck session of Congress, we are facing dramatic shifts in our tax policy, in budget issues. There are threats of what are considered to be major cuts in defense and domestic spending. And, of course, all of this is fueled by the mythology that has been created since the summer of 2011, driven by people like Paul Ryan, that we must reduce our deficit as the top policy objective. And there's much more to the story. And I've been talking for many years with Bill Black, who is now a professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And we first connected when Bill was mopping up the mess from the savings and loan fleecing of the 1980s. And Bill has been writing, and we've referenced this in my daily podcast, about the issues of this fiscal cliff and the efforts to cut the social safety net. And Bill is traveling, so his designated pinch hitter is Professor L. Randall Ray, spelled W-R-A-Y. He's also a professor of economics, University of Missouri, Kansas City, and is a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. Professor, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So tell me your thoughts, just as a kind of overview here, about the context that we find ourselves in. And is this a completely concocted drama that is intended to distract people from what appear to be serious efforts to make long-term cuts in Medicare and Social Security?
Yeah, so if we just go back to the big debate we had about the debt limit and the Republicans refusing to raise it without a compromise, Congress created this fiscal cliff. So this thing was created on purpose. The idea was, oh, let's write a law that would just create havoc in the economy if it ever took effect. And it will take effect in January. And this it's so devastating to the economy, and it's so scary that we then will be forced to make cuts that politically are too difficult for us to make. And those cuts are, as you said, to so-called entitlements, which really is our social safety net.
Mm-hmm. And, Professor, I'm a liberal. I describe myself as an independent progressive, but I don't protect Democrats when they do things that I don't agree with. And when President Obama unilaterally put Social Security and Medicare into the discussion, he injected it in the summer of 2011, I felt it was a very telling moment about who he is and what he really is willing to do. So without any restrictions on your point of view, tell us what your thoughts are about the way Obama has joined forces with the extreme deficit hawks, newly minted as they are, in the Republican Party.
Well, yes, that's true. I mean, our president is standing up before the nation and saying time and time again, we have no choice, we're out of money. Now, this is just plain false. And you don't have to be left wing. You can be right wing. And if you're a serious economist, you know that this is nonsense. Even Alan Greenspan, who's the far right on the political spectrum and also as an economist, has emphasized over and over again that Social Security cannot become insolvent. It's a federal government program. The federal government issues our currency. It can't possibly run out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a lie. And presumably, President Obama has economists around him, even if he doesn't understand the economics, who can tell him, hey, it's just not true. Don't say it anymore. You're lying to the population.
So, Professor Ray, this seems to be a shell game that, you know, we have this, as I say, concocted drama that is playing out, and they want to move us into an austerity mode, probably not as bad as Greece, but some of the same elements are at play here. And the American people don't seem to smell the rat that is in our proverbial kitchen.
The American people have been, as they say, softened up over a very long time period. This whole debate about Social Security began back in the early 1980s with President Reagan and actually Alan Greenspan, who was appointed to this commission to, quote-unquote, reform Social Security. What they did was they raised taxes at the time, and I think that this was a underhanded way to reduce popularity of the program by making the tax more burdensome on American workers and their employers. But anyway, this really was a Republican Party agenda for a very long time. There were only a few fringe Democrats that were on the deficit bandwagon and the entitlements bandwagon. Really until the last decade or so. They finally have gotten on board, and I agree with you. We should not go easy on the Democrats. They are just as guilty as the Republicans in creating the fiscal cliff to provide the political cover that they think they need to destroy the social safety net.
And Professor Ray, one of the things that has irked me is the rollback in the payroll tax. And while I've been assured that that money was backfilled into the Social Security Trust Fund, for a Democratic president to volunteer a reduction in the payroll tax flow into the Social Security Trust Fund, I think is unconscionable. And while the president says, well, he didn't have many options, he was cornered 2 years ago and didn't have the votes to block the extension of the Bush tax cuts, including for the uber wealthy, and that was the best way that he could put money in the pockets of working families. Well, it's the unemployed who needed that boost more than working families. If you've got a job over the past 2 years, chances are that $5 to $15 a week wouldn't make that much difference to you. And so I just have found that Democratic support for a raid of the revenue stream to Social Security in the form of this payroll tax cut, and it, of course, is expiring at the end of the year, too, and there is some support for extending it. But I am very queasy just about the whole mechanism.
Okay, I understand what you are saying, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree with you on this.
All right.
Now, yes, I would give more money to the unemployed. The unemployed benefits should be raised, and the extensions should continue. And, of course, the best thing to do would be to create jobs for them. We don't need to pay them to stay home. They want to work. Let's get them jobs. Okay, so A, on that, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
But B, the payroll tax holiday, I think, is a great idea. And, in fact, I've been promoting it for years. Let's look at what Social Security really is. I know it was sold in the 1930s as an insurance program, and the way that people think about insurance is I pay in, therefore I get to draw out. So from the individual's perspective, that's the way Social Security looks, but it's never been true, it's not true now, and it cannot be true in the future. What Social Security really is an assurance program. We assure you that if you work hard during your working years, so helping to support your family and young people, but also retirees by producing goods and services, in the future, when you're old, the workers of that generation are going to support you. That's what Social Security really is. It's not insurance, and the funding makes no difference at all. What really matters is, can we produce enough right now today to take care of our retirees? The answer is clearly yes. We're not even operating close to full capacity. We can take care of them now. What about 50 years from now when today's young people need retirement? Will we be able to produce for them? On all reasonable projections, assuming we don't completely destroy the environment, the answer is clearly yes. Tomorrow's workers are going to be so much more productive than today's, so that even though we're an aging society, we're going to have a slightly higher ratio of aged to workers, we can do it. That's what matters. The finance doesn't matter. Uncle Sam can't run out of money.
All right. Well, I'll accept your argument there. I don't buy it, but I hear it. And, you know, unless we're going to come up with other ways to put money into the Social Security Trust Fund, and I think you probably agree that we should lift the cap that is artificially set now at about $110,000 of income, it will be hard, and of course maybe attitudes will change, but given the current climate where we are so deeply allergic to anything that can be characterized by Grover Norquist as a tax increase, I guess my first instinct is to protect the revenue stream to the trust fund and try to enhance it as opposed to, diverting some of that money for a short-term stimulus effect.
Very dangerous path that plays into the conservatives' hands. The reason is because as we look to the future on the current projections of the finances, I'm sure you've heard these numbers before, and I'm not talking about way into the infinite horizon, which is what the true enemies of Social Security use. And those are just fantastic, you know, carrying revenues to infinity and beyond and benefit payments to infinity and beyond and then discount it back to the present and claim that we are $70 trillion in the hole. That is absolutely a ridiculous exercise. I'm talking about looking 20 years into the future. What we find is, as everyone says, the tax revenue going into the program is not going to be sufficient to meet the promised benefits, so that the payroll tax rates are going to have to go up over time. The payroll tax rates are already too burdensome on American workers. We don't want to be raising these tax rates. So I think that the payroll tax is not a well-designed tax. It hits only workers. Mm-hmm. It hits only wage income. It hits employers of workers. This is not a good design, especially when we have experienced rising inequality and falling wage share of total income. Now, it could be that these recent these trends that have been going on for 30 years will reverse. Maybe the wage share will increase and the interest and profit share will decline in the future. But that is completely speculative and a risky thing to hang Social Security on. It's much better, I think, to have a broad-based tax that hits all income, not focused on wage income only. And that, if we want to maintain this illusion that taxes pay for the benefits, it's better to have a broad-based tax than the payroll. payroll tax, which is a regressive tax.
Mm-hmm. All right, Professor. Well, I appreciate the exchange there. I do want to focus more, though, on the immediate issues here, and in particular, the efforts to cut back on Medicare benefits as an issue related to the long-term deficit. Are these really linked economically? Is Medicare a driver of the long-term debt, the so-called $16 trillion that we currently have?
Yeah, again, this is one of those silly exercises. If you take the rate of increase of health care spending in the U.S. over the past 20 or 30 years, including Medicare, it's gone up faster than GDP. Now, if you carry that into the future, let's say forever, eventually 100% of GDP is going to be health care. You know, that's just simple and silly mathematics, and that's what all these people are doing. Of course, healthcare costs can't continue to rise faster than GDP, because eventually, if we carry that far enough into the future, it will be all of GDP. We won't consume anything else. Okay? So it's a silly exercise. It won't happen. Now, let's not carry it quite to that extreme. Let's say it just goes on for another decade or so. It's going to bankrupt all households and all firms. The safest part of our healthcare system is Medicare. It's funded by the federal government. It cannot go bankrupt. So in other words, these people who are so focused on the problems with Medicare are completely ignoring that everything they're saying about healthcare costs in Medicare are even more true of our private healthcare system. So this is another reason to argue it cannot continue. We're going to get a handle on healthcare costs, and that will automatically eliminate these so-called unfunded entitlements, because healthcare costs are not going to continue to grow so fast.
So, Professor, talk about the politics of all this and the influence of this alleged think tank of moderates in Washington called the Third Way, and are they actually stalking for Pete Peterson and Wall Street?
Well, yes, I think so. Both Social Security and Medicare offer competition to Wall Street. Wall Street wants to manage your life savings. They don't want you to have the alternative, which is Social Security, and which is what most Americans actually rely on. If they can get rid of Social Security, you'll have no alternative to Wall Street. You're going to have to turn over all of your retirement to them and let them manage it for you, and we know what they're going to do. They're going to charge you high fees, they're going to speculate, they're going to blow the whole wad on a bubble and bust. So they hate Social Security. Medicare is the same thing. It is also competition. In the U.S., the private health care is largely handled by private health insurance companies. And they hate this competition from Medicare, which, of course, right now is providing care mostly to retired people. They would love to force those people into the private health insurance system, where they can suck fee income out of them and make the health care provision for our elderly as dysfunctional as it is for everybody else.
And so what steps do you recommend my listeners take to make their elected representatives aware of their concerns? And is there any will on the part of Democrats to oppose a grand bargain that could be struck between now and the end of the year, which could severely hurt the entitlements that we have earned in Social Security and Medicare?
I think there are sort of two wings in the Democratic Party. There's one wing that is just simply caught up in the deficit and debt hysteria. They are not really after Social Security and Medicare. It's just that they've bought the hype. So the first thing we have to do is calm them down. The Pete Petersons that are running around saying that the debt and deficit are exploding. We've got to convince that wing of the Democratic Party that the budget deficit we have now exists because the economy was destroyed by Wall Street. When we recover, the deficit is going to decline. And, you know, we could conceivably even see some balanced budgets and even some surpluses in the future when the economy grows fast enough. The other wing of the Democratic Party has been bought off by Wall Street. It used to be that Wall Street favored Republicans, and hence it was Republicans that were opposed to the social safety net. But under Clinton, we know that Wall Street was able to buy off a big part of the Democratic Party. So these people are just engaged in payback for campaign funds. What we have to do with this part of the Democratic Party is that the voters have to say, if you touch Social Security or Medicare, you're going to lose your job in the next election. There's just no other way to prevent them from gutting the social programs. So they have to know that they have no chance in the next election if they gut Social Security or Medicare. You have to hold the feet of the politicians to the fire. That's the only way to stop this.
And the Gucci's that we should be heating up are senators, because the House will probably, you know, under Republican control, even in this lame duck session, hang in on a pretty strong Tea Party track. But it is in the Senate where we really can block any kind of serious cuts to the programs we're describing.
I guess you're right. I'm an economist, of course, not a political scientist.
All right. Well, Professor, thanks for joining me today. I enjoyed the conversation. Randall Ray, a professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Hey, Trigger, what do you say we ride off over that fiscal cliff over there and see what happens?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.